Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors this week. We have Harvest, time tracking and invoicing for professionals. Check that out at getharvest.com. And Environments for Humans, who are doing their In Control conference this February 17th through 19th in Orlando, Florida. We'll tell you more about both those things later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off. We don't have a soundboard this week. Dave is traveling, so I got to just play some banjo for you. Shop Talk Show!
Shop Talk Show!
Howdy, y'all. You're listening to the Shop Talk Show. A very, very special analog episode of the Shop Talk Show. I am Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Tiffer Coyer.
Hi, Chris. Everybody. Thanks for tuning in to Shop Talk Show. This is a special analog episode. Might happen from time to time here, folks.
So who do we have in the studio today?
In the studios, we have Emily Dunkel. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
Ta-da!
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here and thoroughly impressed with your banjo playing skills.
Thank you. I don't pick it up very often, but now that Dave made me get it out, it's going to make me take it home for the holidays, which I'm going to enjoy. So what's up, Emily? You are a UX designer, developer. What's your professional life like?
Well, I'm working for MIT right now, the MIT Technology Review, which is MIT's media company and magazine publication.
MIT's a college, right?
Yes.
Basically. And then so they have some branch of it that is this blog, essentially. What does it say on your paycheck? MIT?
MIT. I get paid directly from MIT, but we're sort of we're owned by MIT, this magazine, and we are morphing into more of a media operation because we put on lots of events. One big event every year called MTech here in Cambridge. But we have the online publication, which we post about 2 and 6 stories a day, and then we have a bi-monthly magazine, print magazine as well.
Right on. There's lots of that's at technologyreview.com.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
That's the hub for it.
Right.
You're the designer.
My official title there, user interface /digital designer is my official title. but I do lots of visual design, some UX, lots of UX, and a little bit of front-end development here and there when necessary. But I usually try to leave that to the programmers that I work with. So.
Oh, right on. So what's your, design tool of choice then? Is that already...
I use Fireworks primarily.
Interesting. For so are you sad that it's end of life?
Yes, I'm clinging to it. I am really sad.
I use Fireworks too, and it just keeps getting worse, I feel like.
I think so too. Yeah, I feel like it knows when I'm not, it does this weird bug thing now where if I try to save and I'm not looking at it, I swear it doesn't save.
I have to. Tracking.
Yeah, it knows if I'm not paying enough attention to it, and then the bugs show up. I think anyway.
It used to have really awesome vector support. Like you could copy a Illustrator file and paste it right into right into Fireworks. But now they remove that in version 6 or whatever. So now it's totally ugh.
Yes, it bitmaps everything. It flattens everything when you.
What is up with removing features as a thing? I know that's hip, and we all talk about that as designers. You know, it's so Apple-like to just simplify. But it's people have been taking it to some extreme lately, including Apple. Man, that was the talk of the town when they kind of downgraded all those iWork apps, which seemed to affect everybody.
Yeah.
I don't know. People were really mad about Keynote, and then me and Dave actually use Numbers for our accounting on, and all of a sudden it's just much harder because that thing in spreadsheets where this is a total aside. I'm sorry, but that thing where You're a, yeah. There's a column and it's full of words and there's only like 3-4 different words it can possibly be, right? Like it, like sponsorship, sponsorship, sponsorship. And you go to the next one and you type SP, it should autofill sponsorship for you because clearly that's what you're trying to type. It can like guess that. It doesn't do that anymore. Or that thing where if you like have a like a number on the left, like an ID, 12345, you used to be able to click a few of those and then drag it down and it would kind of sense the theme going on there and continue that theme going down to the bottom. I feel like that's like fundamental spreadsheet feature that's just been removed. So like every little tiny thing I do, it's like, no, we don't even support that anymore. Boo.
Yeah, no, it's not that great. So MIT, that sounds like you work with a lot of smart people all the time.
Yes, I do.
I would be super intimidated. I'm not sure.
It can be. No, it can be. I think my first week here, I ate lunch with some of the editors, and the lunch conversation was about like deep, you know, tracking the genome and all the stuff that I have I know nothing about. And I was like,
maybe that's like a hazing ceremony that they do.
Yeah, maybe it was on purpose. I don't know.
So does it attract? I mean, even so. You know, I'm sure you're extremely smart, Emily, but like, is there like, did they test your IQ before you can even, it's mostly just a normal job, right? You don't have to be a genius to. Yeah.
Right. They didn't test my IQ that I know of. I mean, who knows how long they've been watching me before I started. No. It was a normal job, and we have a normal like product development department here. That's just me and a project manager and two programmers, a front end and a back end. So, and we run things like any other normal, web department, I think.
Sure. It's a nice looking website. I know I feel like we should probably talk about it for a minute because it's this, I'm sure you look at it all day long, right? This is your,
primary one. And we actually relaunched it, it was a huge relaunch with a new brand, a brand suite, new logo. Entirely new tech stack and new visual design and UX on the website. And change. We used to be just Technology Review and we changed to MIT Technology Review. So got MIT in the name.
Yeah. But not responsive or mobilized.
Right. We have a basic mobile solution in place right now, which it's pretty much like an RSS of, some of the news stories, but, mobile is the next project on our roadmap, starting probably in January. So we did not do it mobile first, I hate to say. And we have a pretty basic mobile solution in place right now, but hopefully that's going to change in the next few months.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just curious if that, because I mean, it's especially relevant to people who are listening to the show, and I think they would wonder like, why not, or what your reasoning was. It's just kind of like a time thing, or is there specific things that like you can't get around that were especially hard right now?
It was definitely a resources thing for when we relaunched last October, because we were previously on a CMS that had been built by our backend programmer like 6 years ago. So we moved on to Drupal.
Custom jobby.
Yeah. And that was what I was asking too. You know, I would have loved to tackle the mobile piece along with while we were putting everything else on the table. But it just couldn't happen for, you know, business reasons, things that were out of my control as the designer, the lone designer.
There's one. You're a design team of one.
Kind of. I'm the only designer in the product development team, but we also have an art team that works on the print magazine, and they produce like the daily stories and things. So there's other designers, but they're more editorial designers, and I'm the only like UI/UX person.
Okay, cool. I think it gives us a good picture of what's going on there. So you're people can find you at emilydunkel.com, and you're one.
Yes.
You're like me in that you just use your name for stuff. So twitter.com/emilydunkel, emilydunkel on Dribbble.
Exactly.
Very cool. What do you got, Dave? Do you have any?
Well, guys, are you ready? Ka-chung! For the hot drama portion of the Shop Talk Show. I wanted to bring this up. Somebody on Twitter was like, hey, talk about this. And so this is going to be tough to talk about because we have to keep our PG rating here at the Shop Talk Show. But if you point your browser to Mother bleepingwebsite.com, that's mother, word you can't say to your mother, ing website.com, and check it out. It's basically like a troll. It's pretty, just, it's basically like, I made
you see it, Emily?
Yes, I did see this.
yeah. I don't, what do you guys think? Is he spot on, or he or she? I think it's a he, but I just saw it in the source or whatever. But anyway, any feedback for this website?
I kind of love this because I think we tend to overthink things so often that, you know, and perfect and innovative can be the enemy of just getting something out there and putting something up. So yeah, if it's just an unstyled basic HTML page, then, and that's all you got, go with it at first. I mean, it's sort of launching with the minimum, it's an MVP, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Minimum viable product. That's what we have here.
Is that, yeah, I like that sentiment, but I wonder if this, if he would then look at technologyreview.com and be like, nope, doing it wrong, too much. Do less, or would he? Because I would disagree in that case. I would think that you know, your RSS version of this or whatever isn't as compelling as looking at technologyreview.com as it is now. And there's things like business requirements, like there's people who work at this website and that need to be paid and are paid via the advertisements on it or whatever. And it's a little too simplified, the sentiment of motherbleepingwebsite.com. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it just doesn't, I don't know, like, does, I like the sentiment. I think there's things we can learn. We could, simplification is a good message, but to just, it's just, it's not always that simple to just be like, wow, right. Well, just strip out the CSS and it's better now. See?
I mean, I thought it was a good website, a nice little troll. I tried to sell this design to a client, and they weren't on board.
They weren't interested, yeah.
Surprisingly, they were, like, unacceptable. So I don't know what to say. I mean, I tried my best, you know, but it was just didn't make it across the table. So
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe next year. Well, it'll be that progressive, yeah. That will.
And it got tweeted so much because of the word bleep, right? Which is like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I wish we could make our point with a little less.
Tootin'.
I don't know. It's just not a little easy,
mother
right?
Mother tootin' website.
Actually, I would have. Then I would have actually tweeted it. I didn't done this. And it's not that I'm like Captain PG. I'm totally not. But I do like to watch it a little bit. And this is a little heavy on that side, I feel like. And like, I don't know. Some kids follow me and stuff. I don't want to get in trouble with their dad.
No, it's all your fault, Chris Coyer. You're ruining
the
youth of
the nation.
Is that
it for drama? Has there anything else happened like this week that was intentionally?
No, not that I can
really
think
of. Here's an idea.
So.
I got an idea. We should maybe have a recap show or a recap blog post or something where we look back through the history of Shop Talk at each of the things that we declared were drama of that week, and then see what came of the drama, and are we in a better place now that the drama happened? As we'll just have to kind of guess if that's the case or not, or are we in a worse place, or was there no change? So we could look at and see if hot drama ends up being a good thing or not. You know, like, does the awareness that hot drama rises make things better at the end of it or not?
I do know 2013 was the most peaceful year in all of humanity. The least amount of wars and bombs dropped, I believe. So there you go. Probably due to this podcast.
Very likely.
Anyhow. All right. Well, that's all I got. We should do that. We'll have to put a hot drama. What is it? Post-mortem?
Showdown.
Or
post-mortem. There you
peri-mortem.
Go. What does Google call it when they do that thing at the end of the year?
This year in hot drama. This year in hot drama.
I feel like there's a word for it that's kind of fancy. It's okay.
Annuum.
Yeah, something like that.
I give up. Go, Nibs.
So we have a bunch of questions that will be interesting to get Emily's take on here. So I've selected a bunch of. Is that what you want to do, or do you got more to?
Oh, I was going to say you added a feature for CodePen and you.
Oh right, I like here. To just because I'm like, you know what, I do this podcast, but I only rarely mention the fact of the other things that I do for. So I'm going to try to do that once in a while when I can, and it's about. I happen to have gone to a variety of conferences in this past year, and sometimes I see people using CodePen, one of the web apps I work on, to present code. Literally, they'll just open a thing that they made, and I'm sure most people listen to the show know what CodePen is. If you don't, it's at codepen.io, and it'll be pretty obvious once you get there. But like, it's well suited for a desktop browser, but it's not all that well suited to project onto a overhead projector, just because. Oh, I don't know, for a variety of reasons. There's not as much screen space available as would be nice on one of those things. The overhead projectors can often be super low resolution, like even 800 by 600, and you're like, oh my god, this doesn't fit at all. So anyway, we kind of made this new view on CodePen that is specifically for overhead projectors to maximize the space, make it real easy to change colors and font sizes and stuff, so you can kind of dial in a perfect scenario for whatever kind of overhead projector you're working with. So that's a brand new feature on CodePen. I just thought I'd mention it here because it's my podcast. I'll do what I want.
Awesome. All right. First question. Meat and potatoes of the Shop Talk Show. Here we go. Matt Monaco writes in, says, I have worked at an agency and also as a freelancer. The last year and a half I have been working for a not-for-profit.
For Lots some of reason, different experience.
For some reason, the IT department here have taken full control of the website all the way down to the UX. Ooh, hostile takeover. I like it. Here we go. Being the only person in this office with any web experience at all, I am the one who seems to fully understand the damage they do on a daily basis. I'm even left out of discussions involving the website. Are some dogs just too old to teach new tricks? This company's online presence is an utter shambles, and some days I don't see the light. Oh, it's pretty sad. But Emily, do you have any advice? Can an old dog learn new tricks, or what should
Matt do? Old dog in this scenario.
Yeah,
these IT.
That's a tough man. That's a tough situation. What I would do is see if you could run some kind of usability test or gather some kind of data. Have something like hard metrics to show people that you work with that. Can actually show in numbers that the website's terrible or that what people are doing is making things worse. So, because I think if you can get a developer or one of the IT people to sit in on a usability test and watch someone struggle with the work that they're doing, that can really open their eyes. I mean, hopefully, and sort of show them that there are actual users out there that get their hands on this stuff, and the decisions that they make, that the IT department might be making in house, aren't always the best for the user. So if they could, you know, any kind of, it doesn't have to be a fancy usability study. Just go out and ask people to use something, you know, at Starbucks, or ask friends and family to do a couple of tasks. And if you can record it, audio, video, anything that you can have to show that users are having a hard time with things, like have hard proof and evidence, I think.
Yeah, because it's hard to argue step. Against data, right?
You know, yeah.
Or real stuff. And now I guess I would advise to be a little careful, because it sounds like there's some politics or something else going on here, because they're literally, mm-hmm. what did you say? I am even left out of discussions involving the website, right? So I get the vibe, and, you know, sorry if I'm incorrect here, Matt, but I get the vibe that maybe they don't even like you very much, you know, as if they really, like, really loved you at work there. You'd probably be invited to some of these things, because they probably know that you have some web experience, right? I mean, that's your job there. So if they already don't like you, and then you show up with this, you know, with this video of someone struggling to use something that they specifically worked on, they're going to like you even less, I bet. So I wonder if there's a light touch kind of thing that you could do, or kind of just kind of go rogue and kind of do something awesome for the website and be like, look at this awesome thing I did for the website, and kind of see what the reaction is there. That's a sad situation, because if that doesn't go well, now you're stuck at this job working on a website that you don't like with people that don't like you. And it's like, what a disaster. You know, it may be time to kind of get out of there. It sounds like a kind of a bummer situation, but I know that's not always easy either. So I'm not sure. What do you have?
Yeah, it sounds like it might involve some relationship building, like on a personal level, even if it's just having lunch or having coffee or, you know, reaching out more on a, you know, just to build more of a culture with
another
group, then you can start you're in about making better changes for the website. But
I can you see being the only person in the office with any web experience at all is something that you said, Matt, too. But that's interesting, too. I would maybe open your mind a little bit. I mean, they're currently working on the website. So whether they don't have like up to date or good web experience, in your opinion right now, they do have some web experience because they're making the website. So maybe just kind of open up some understanding there too, and teaching.
I mean, we talk about empathy a lot with UX. So you sort of turn that towards the people that you work with, and, you know, try and see where they're coming from, or if it's coming from the top down, or if it's trickling down from another department or another C-level executive. You know, why? Try and get to the root of why it's happening.
I believe it was Sun Tzu of The Art of War who said, "To know your enemy, you must become your enemy." And supreme excellence consists of breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting.
Wow. I like that you just have that locked and loaded.
Recently I was like, what does The Art of War say about like conflict resolution or whatever? But anyway, just because it's an old book that's withstand the test of time. But I think you're going to have to do some inter office politicking. And then I liked what Emily said, like, you know, data talks and BS walks, as far as I'm concerned. And because people really can't really, like, they can call data into question and be like, well, that study wasn't done right. But it's like, well, but it's the only study we have, so what do you want to do about it, you know? I also liked what you said, Chris. Maybe go rogue and like redesign the website and just be like, here, I made a thing, and like rock star it. Maybe that's an option, but that also might be your last hurrah there, and you might be shown out the door because you didn't actually do your job for 2 weeks or whatever. I don't know. You guys, yeah.
I think that we summed it up nicely for Matt. Let us know how it goes. Matt, I'd love to hear a postmortem of that scenario.
Oh, Luke. Hold on. I have an actual gun here. Hold on. Let me just get
just kidding. Just one. Awesome. That would be amazing.
All right. Luke from London.
Yeah, he asks, just wondered what approach you guys take to testing your sites, not just design, but also functionality and calculations, etc. Do you write tests or use any nice tools? I put this one in here because I'd be kind of interested to know what Emily does with your kind of design testing. I mean, we could focus on the design bit for now and then kind of go from there, I guess.
Yeah, sure. So when I'm working on stuff, I like to do little tests just with people from other departments, and, you know, grab someone that has no idea what my project is and get them to be sort of a first-time user on it, just to see how they react and what their behaviors are. Mm-hmm. But in terms of actual, you know, usability testing, we've done Steve Krug, who wrote Don't Make Me Think, he ran a usability testing event here in Cambridge, I think back in January. And we had our site, my project manager and I went and, you know, conducted some usability tests under the guidance of Steve Krug, you know, based on some of the main tasks and goals that we have down as the main things that our users want to do on the site. So that was cool. So we did some in-person usability testing. We've done remote usability testing on usertesting.com, you know, where you can set up like 10 different tasks for someone to do, and they record themselves and talk while they're doing it. So you can kind of see what they're doing without actually being there. That's kind of cool. But unfortunately, we don't do usability testing that often. I would like to do it more, so I sort of just do it informally with people that I can grab in the office. But for formal usability testing, we've only really done it when we have something major launching, which isn't ideal, but that's the reality of how it is for my department.
Mm-hmm. I guess, and then as far as like actual, like what does it look like in different scenarios, situation? I don't know. Do you do much of that? Like, if a report comes in that the website doesn't look good in whatever some specific browser?
We have a really small device library here, just in our office that we use while we're building things, but we'll use like what is it? Is it Blaze.io?
I've never heard of that.
I think that's what it is.
What does it do? Just, I mean, even if we don't have the name for it.
Yeah, you can type your URL in and select which devices you want it to be tested on remotely, and somewhere in some warehouse it loads up, and it'll test like load time, and you could see what it looks like. It'll send you screenshots of the page and show you some metrics on how your website loaded on a particular device that you you don't have in your office. So I don't know where that site went. It used to be Blaze.io, but we've done that in the past.
Yeah, okay, that's cool. And I suppose that will, I mean, you haven't even launched into your mobile phase yet. You said January probably, right. So like maybe that will grow in that time.
Yes. Yeah, we just really done spot checking up to this point, which isn't the best, but come a few months from now, it'll be a different story.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you do, Dave, when for like cross-browser testing?
Oh man, just a lot of manual refreshing through browser stack, which isn't that awesome. That's actually like something I'm looking to optimize in 2014 is just how we do all that. I've been looking at two libraries recently, Wraith from the BBC News team, and you can go to, it's on GitHub, Wraith, Wraith. But it's this comparison tool, so it'll like check like regression tests in your website. So you run it, and if you like do a git commit or whatever, or you could probably do it all from like a grunt task. You just say like whatever, run test, and it'll use this thing called Slimer.js, which is pretty cool. It just talks to Phantom.js or whatever, Casper.js, blah, blah, blah. And it'll find out
Well, the point is Phantom can spit out literally a graphic that it's made because it's like a version of WebKit, right? And then so this tool, it looks like it will do it twice, with the old, with what your test image is, what you want it to look like. And then now after your commit, it will take another image and then compare the two. And if they're too different, I suppose it will give you some kind of warning.
Yeah. Yep. And like, it'll overlay the image and like show the difference and stuff like that. And then I heard about on JS Jabber, the guys we just had on recently, I was on listening to their podcast, and they had one of the guys from Facebook on and from the Instagram team, Peter Hunt, I guess it was. And, they were talking about Huxley, which is like the way Instagram does these like visual regressions and stuff like that. So it's kind of a cool thing. Like you could find out, where you you'd get notified if you messed things up. Like if there was a huge difference between two files or whatever.
Yeah. Visual testing is interesting, right? It's kind of a form of CSS testing, because that's what would change visually things, right? You would probably do this too on a test page that uses some common CSS, right? Something that you don't expect the content to change very much, because that would cause a huge diff, and then but that doesn't matter,
Yeah. This would be like static templates or whatever that you're testing.
I'm interested in that. Like when I want to test for CodePen, that's like when I click this button and that button happens to trigger like a dialogue or something, I want to make super sure that that dialogue is the top visible thing on the page, you know, because that would be a form of a regression, right? Is that I screwed up some Z index somewhere in some CSS, and that now that dialogue is showing up underneath something else. Like, why can't I write it? Like, writing a test for that to make sure that it's sent up is like really hard.
Yeah, it's possible, you know, and like you have to use, I think, like one of those frameworks like Mocha or whatever. But I think it's totally possible. But yeah, this is what I'm looking to get into in 2014. Just like user can open menu and, you know, go to the menu button, click menu, and it should show the menu.
So now, but now we're in like a world of there's some DOM stuff involved. There's some event triggering involved. There's possibly image diffing involved. It's like, it's taking a lot of what we think of testing frameworks and like squishing them together. Like, mm-hmm. It's rather complicated. Anyway, Luke, I'm not sure how deep you wanted us to dive there, but I think we got from UX testing to different types of testing kind of covered there a little bit.
Hopefully.
Let me do a quick sponsor here. Harvest is a time tracking tool. Like I said at the top of the show, for professionals, spend less time tracking and more time doing. It's literally a web-based tool to track your time. And they have desktop apps as well, so you don't have to like sit there with the tab open at all the time. I always kind of like, not laugh, but like there's startup time tracking tools. Like everybody and their brother is like, I'm going to do a time tracking tool, but it's going to be cheaper or something. You know, like, ooh, that's your whole business plan. I'm not sure that's going to succeed. Anyway, a little bit of a tangent there, but I feel like you kind of have to have some desktop tool because the things that you have access to as a desktop tool are kind of better. For instance, like detecting if you're idle or not. I know I've mentioned this before, but I think that's a sweet thing that Harvest does, is like you start time tracking on a project, then you accidentally walk away and you forget to hit stop and you come back. We'll tell, oh, you've been idle on your computer. Were you working on that job, but just not at your computer? Yes, apply that time to the job. Or if not, you know, slice it off, you know, so you can't like screw up your time tracking either, which is cool. Or you could then hop onto your phone and stop it from there, because they have mobile apps too that kind of keep everything in sync. So it's not just time tracking, but then you're applying that to projects. It produces all these reports. So it's not just you this is useful to, it's other people on your team, like your team managers and the accounting people and whatnot. And you can create invoices right from it. So it's the time tracking and the reports and the invoicing. And it starts at like $12 a month. So it's a pretty sweet tool for that. And anybody I know who does serious time tracking uses Harvest. So that's them. Thanks for sponsoring the show very much. Maybe I should do like a thank you, you know, like a...
Oh! Nailed it.
Hands on home row. You know how it's like typing with your key. Oh, yeah, then I dropped the banjo and it's out of tune.
Okay. Production level at an all-time high here. Lucas Hostetler, I nailed it, writes in, and this is, I'm very interested in Emily's point of view. Here we go. Will macaw and similar tools replace web designers? Obviously, it won't kill the web design industry, but it seems like macaw has gained a lot of attraction and could be used by people who don't know how to even code or even know what HTML is to create their websites. Thanks in advance. Love the show. Emily?
Have you seen macaw, Emily?
Yes, I'm really excited about it, actually. I'm hoping maybe that can replace fireworks when that finally dies on me.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm excited about macaw, and I don't think it will replace web designers, because there's already lots of things out there that we've asked the same question about, like Dreamweaver and you know, other sort of visual coding things that could potentially, you know, let someone who doesn't know anything about design or coding to build a website, which is fine. And I kind of like that there's these tools out there for people that, you know, want to start learning or, you know, can't afford to hire a web designer. And this is going to be a really nice tool for designers and non-designers alike, I think. So I don't think it will replace the profession entirely, because there's still, you know, you have to know design principles, and there's the entire, you know, academic study of design in general. So there will always be that profession, but I think this will make us better at our jobs.
Probably. Nice. So it's just all positive all the time from the
yeah.
Yeah. The URL, if people haven't seen it yet, is macaw.co. And so it's not actually out yet. You can't actually just get and play with Macaw yet. It was a Kickstarter that did super well. And the video was super viral because people are like, ooh, for the first time, like maybe ever in this industry, people were oohing and aahing at a visual design tool. Normally the sentiment is yuck, you know, because it's such a difficult prospect. You know, the things that we do today with CSS and HTML and how we think about it and do it, it just doesn't seem like it's a easy thing to translate to a tool. And certainly we can visually do things, but Macaw is beyond visual design. It's then when you're done with the visual design, it purports to kind of have already built it in code, right? Like, so once you're done with the visual angle, you're like, you're also done with the coding angle, which is kind of amazing.
And I don't think it's like some kind of transpiler. I think it's like you're actually making code, from my understanding. And is that like, yeah, it's like a web kit?
You don't not see numbers either. It's like it shows you numbers and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can make, you know, kind of nerdy decisions on that. And it's been a while since I've seen the video, so if I have any of that wrong, feel free to yell at me. My sentiment is, A, it's amazing, and yes, we do need these tools, and whether you want them or not, they're going to come. So get used to it. But I do think it's also placed rather strangely. So Emily's excited about it. I'm excited about it too, because it's the future of tools and I want to see it and it's going to push things forward. But who is it specifically for? And I was kind of trying to think, like, if you're a startup, let's say you're trying to pitch this to an investor or something, like, what is your audience? Is it really kind of advanced website builders? Is it targeting the three of us in some way? I'm like, you know, maybe a little bit. I'm not sure that there's a level of trust there that you'd have to gain that is going to be a huge hurdle for you. It doesn't seem like you're going to get a huge adoption of advanced website builders right away. It's going to be a hard sell there because they're attached to their code. You know, I don't find writing HTML and CSS so difficult that I even need help with it, really. Sometimes I need some abstraction help, but I kind of prefer working in the code in a way. So I don't think that's like enough. You're not going to get enough users there to really make it worth it. And is it for, like, I've never touched a design tool ever in my life? I don't think so either. Like, as Emily, like Emily said, you need to know some design fundamentals and there's so many tools. You know, it looks very Photoshop like, and there's just tools everywhere. It doesn't look like it's a beginner tool. So maybe it's this middle layer of people, or maybe it's trying to win over those advanced people. I'm not sure. Like, I don't feel like the target is super clear with a tool like Macaw, who's going to end up using it. So I'm not sure.
Yeah. I think it might be a great prototyping tool as well. You know,
where you don't really care what you the code is.
Right. You may not put the code through to production, but it might work to illustrate an interaction mm-hmm. that you're trying to show someone.
Yeah, good point.
I think anything that helps us get to code faster is awesome. I don't think this is like designed for me, you know, like an old dog again, like I'm doing things on the command line, blah, blah, blah. But like, you know, I would have never, ever, ever gotten to web design without Dreamweaver and being able to just drag a stupid image onto a stupid, like, white piece of paper and then, like, pushing that to the website, you know? These tools, I think, are necessary for anyone, like, in the phases of web design or whatever. I mean, that's my opinion, but...
Yeah, for a new breed.
There's a lot of people who have never even used Photoshop before, but I feel like everyone kind of has started in either Photoshop or Dreamweaver or Fireworks or something at some point.
Lucas's first question, will it replace web designers?
I don't think so. I mean, this is where it comes like what is web design? A web design is actually not just the graphics, it's how you laid out the information. It's how you created balance out of chaos. And, you know, maybe I'm a little too high on my view of web design, but that just seems exactly what it is. It's just these kind of these psychology concepts, these, you know, color theory and all this stuff. That's what web design is. And it all kind of meets together. So, maybe I'm talking out my butt, but that's what it feels that to me is what web design is.
Emily, what about, let's say maybe not macabre, but let's say there is a tool that made it really, really, really super easy to make your own really kind of nice website. And I would say there are tools like that. Things like Squarespace and Verb make really nice websites, and you literally need to know almost nothing about web design to use them. How do you feel about those tools?
I love those tools as well. And I think I've heard you talk about Squarespace before, Chris, and I agree with your what you've said before. Like, it's when, you know, people come to me and want help with their websites, you know, it might be like a friend who's a musician or a family member who runs their own small business or something. Squarespace is perfect for them because they don't need to hire a professional designer to, you know, have a really unique website, because Squarespace has beautiful designs and they could do everything just there. So I recommend it all the time to people. So, and I love that kind of stuff.
You're a web designer and you're recommending it.
Yeah, you're right. And the more of, you know, those we have, I think the better. I think there will always be a place for, you know, because Squarespace isn't that expensive for someone. So if they can have like a cheapish, easy way to build a really nice looking website, that's awesome. Because there's always going to be the big clients who need to hire designers to do custom work. But for people that need just sort of a basic static-ish website with maybe a blog, I love those solutions.
Yeah. I couldn't this week. We don't even have Squarespace on as a sponsor, but they've sponsored in the past. I'm going to paste this site, McCormickPhotos.net. This happened this week. My buddy's like, "Oh, I need a bunch of changes to the website." I'm like, "I did this for you kind of a long time ago." I'm still like, "Could you, like, I really recommend, Scott, that you go and just do it on Squarespace. It's going to be easy. You'll be able to pick a theme that you love. You'll be able to just drop your photos in there." He's largely a photographer. And it's just going to be this amazing site. You're not going to need to call me. You're going to have all the power in the world over your website. And then I look at his site. Hopefully the DNS is still propagating. So hopefully it looks like a grid of like 9 images.
Yeah. Yeah.
Clicking it. Mm-hmm. Look at how awesome that is, you know? Nobody had to do anything for Scott. He's just like, "Oh, yeah, I'm just going to drop some photos on here and put some text on there, and there we go." And it's, like, beautiful. It's, like, it's much nicer than anything I could have done for him, at least quickly, you know?
And he's a couple grand richer or whatever. Just that's right, even his pennies, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. There you
Pretty
go.
Sweet, I think.
All right. Well, next question, shall we?
Yeah.
All right. Micah Mills writes in, "I have been a web developer for 4 years and I recently built a site for a client that is by far the worst I have built in my career." They chose me to build the site because of my experience with mobile first responsive web designs. However, the client wanted to design the site herself. After a lengthy discussion of how to design for responsive design and not to do things, she came back completely ignoring all my advice and provided an awful design. Despite all my planning and pushback, she wouldn't budge. So I was left having to build the site, and make all of her bad UX UI decisions work on mobile devices. How would you have handled this situation? Should I intentionally ignore best practices because the client doesn't understand how the web works like it, or the client doesn't understand and wants the web to work like it did in 2001? # sick burn. Emily, any thoughts there?
I don't know. That sounds, I mean, I wonder if he had a contract in place because they were a designer. He was going to be the designer of the site. Is that right?
Right. I think so. Yeah.
That might be a breach of contract and, you know, grounds for ending your contract with that person and just getting out of the job entirely. Because if it's not something you're proud of, then you're not going to, it's not going to be in your portfolio. You're not going to want to show it to people. But having the client themselves do the design work could be a breach of what your terms of agreement, depending on how you structure the contract and what it actually says in there. But I probably would have tried to get out of that.
Yeah, that may be the answer, you know, because there's not, you know, everybody's got bills and stuff. So maybe you just kind of got to power through here. And in a way, you're in the business of client services. So at some point, there's situations where you need to suck it up and do some work and get paid and let it go. And then there's situations where walking away is better for you. It's better for them. It's better to move on with each other's lives. Surely, you know, and we don't know every detail about this situation. So that's tough. But yeah, I'm not sure. That would be a bummer if you were going to design the site, then somebody just sent you a design that you thought was terrible. And now, did this happen? Was this just one exchange? Was it, you know, you said you had a lengthy discussion about responsive design and things not to do, and then they ignored you once, or were they ignoring you over and over and over again? Because I feel like this is a complicated stuff, right? And it's your job to help educate and walk this through. Mike Montiero had a talk I saw recently that I really liked about his experience buying a bicycle. And he felt very uncomfortable walking into the bicycle store because he doesn't know anything about bicycles. And it can be an awkward situation. You know, I don't know what the latest in componentry is in the bike world. And he got someone to sell him a bike that just made the experience fantastic. They understood that somebody buying a bike doesn't know everything about bikes. It explained what the different bikes were and what the differences were and talked about budget and what was available and everything. And by the time he left, he was very happy buying that bicycle. Can't you feel that? Like it's nerve-wracking for someone to work with a designer too, because chances are they've never bought a website before. They don't know what it's like. They don't know all the stuff that you know. You might want them to, but they don't. So just if they push back once or screw something up once, you know, be patient and try to teach it to them again and explain why their design might not work in that situation. It's not saying that I'm not trying to side with them. You know, maybe they are a pain in the ass. Maybe you do need to fire them. But chances are it's one of those patience issues. And, you know, and then I really like that Emily brought up the contract thing, because that's apparently nothing but saved people's butts in the past, is having a smart contract so that you can not rely on, you know, you can, you know, rely on agreed to legal facts, not hearsay.
Right. And someone mentioned in the chat room, and you mentioned Mike Montiero, but his book, Design as a Job, is a great resource for all the side of web design and that we don't really get taught. And we always just kind of have to learn on the fly. But the client services part and billing and all that, the tough part of the business side, it's a great resource. I would recommend reading that to the person that asked the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think we need a little bit of realism and just not every project's like a home run, you know, where no one's like batting 1,000 on super success or like successful client interactions. So, you know, you got to just kind of like, you know, there's a few things, you know, you just be like, I don't know, if you like can smell that out at the beginning that you're not going to be involved in the design and they're just like doing the like, hey, monkey, code this thing, dude, your rate goes up or whatever. And that's like your suffering tax or something. I'm not, you know, and I'm not trying to like be like ruthless, but like, if you're not going to enjoy it, you know, maybe you raised your rate 10 bucks and you're just like, hey, now every 10 hours I have to deal with them and their nonsense, I get $100 and that's awesome. So I get an extra $100. So I think you should consider doing that. So make it worth your while if you're suffering through people's nonsense. IMHO.
In Control is coming up this February 17th through 19th in Orlando, Florida. I've been a bunch of years this year. Dave will be representing Team Shop Talk in Orlando. Hey-o. So go to incontrolconference.com. It'll redirect you to 2014.incontrolconference there. It's still early bird ticket pricing as I speak this. So if you're in the chat room now and are convinced by my wooing that this is a good plan for you, they're $495. If you wait until through Cyber Monday, you know, the Monday after Thanksgiving or whatever, after that, it jumps up $100. So it's a good time to buy it now if you can kind of convince yourself, convince your family, convince your boss, whatever. It's going to be pretty sweet. They have released the keynotes now. So Scott McCloud, that should be pretty interesting. He's like talks about comics. You know, so it's kind of like a little outside of our industry a little bit, but should be super interesting. And then Daniel Ryan, who was the director of front-end development for President Obama's campaign in 2012. So pretty interesting stuff there. Plus Dave, obviously. So it's just worth it right there.
Yayo.
Yep.
My talk is going to be how to get Brad Frost to use the command line. That's going to be my whole talk. I'll just walk Brad through the command line.
I've struggled. I get it. I totally get it. But I do the basic things I need to do in it. And now that I'm getting into grunt a little bit, ooh, I'm all over it.
A little hyped, huh?
Yeah, I'm doing 24 ways, that thing that comes out every year or whatever. Mm-hmm. I got to do one. It's the first year I've gotten to participate in that. And I'm doing it on grunt, and I'm doing it in the kind of from the Chris Coyer certified method of,
grok it hard.
Yeah, well, kind of like if you, I think the title, if they're going to let me title it, this is going, God, I feel like I'm like breaching a contract here or something, but who cares? I'm not going to give you the article yet. I'm going to try to title it grunt for people who think things like grunt are weird and hard. So it should be good that way. Anyway, in control, going to be sweet. Go hang out with Dave.
It's always
still
fun.
Just trying to decide if I'm going to fly down for it or not. I'm not sure that I can.
Come on, do it. All right. Okay. Let's do a couple more. We got a couple more. We'll see how far we get. Brian Pierce writes in, I just got done building the new Corner Bakery Cafe website. I was the lead front end developer on the project, and it is responsive as SHIT, which is awesome. I had a topic for you guys if you haven't covered it before. I had a lot of trouble helping junior developers and back end developers who are helping build out the front end segments follow guidelines I had set in the project. Some of it was lack of experience, and some of it was lack of understanding, and some of it was lack of giving in SHIT. I would like to get your opinion and thoughts on how to better interact with other developers who either don't care or don't have an understanding for why and how you have laid out your markup the way you have. I would love to be on the show and discuss the project in its entirely. So anyway, it sounds like an interesting project. So,
you're a front end developer. You set up these patterns, guidelines, design patterns, whatever. Now you need to get junior developers who may not be familiar with that stuff as well to follow them. You need back end developers to follow them. Have you been in this position, Emily?
I've never set the guidelines in terms of code, I don't think, but I've worked with people who are trying to build standards and, have those kind of guidelines. So I think I can understand the problem.
What about just, you've designed a pattern before, right?
Oh, sure.
And they tend to make it to, do they tend to kind of make it to the final product as you intended generally?
Yeah. And I guess my version of that would be like working with a front end developer, and sometimes not all the nuances of the design will make it into the front end code. So I think, just clear communication and working, which can be hard, I guess. and working as closely as you can with the person and having, having direct access to them has always been great. Like being able to turn around and ask the developer how things are going, or if they need to, ask me to cut some images.
And hopefully
for them,
they feel comfortable doing that, right? Like there may be some politics here as well. You can't just design a pattern and drop the mic, right? You got to be there to be the shepherd of your patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. And be willing to tell or explain why you do things certain ways. Because if someone questions why, I think that's valid. If they're just blatantly not following the patterns, something else might be going on. But being willing to share your why you made certain decisions the way that you did, I think is will help with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it isn't a lot of the things that we talk about, like, try to be a better person. Seems like that solves a lot of problems, even though it'll probably solve other problems in your life.
Is that, you know, a new sound effect? Be a better person.
I feel like some of the questions we not usually, but you know, the type of question where somebody is just like, I did this and nobody respects me, and why don't they listen to my smart ways? Everybody else is stupid, you know. And then they go right to, you know, somebody else be like, my dentist doesn't respect me. It probably just moves to all different parts of their life, you know, or whatever. Or it's just this problem keeps coming up, and I don't know. That's a stupid thing. I should just shut up.
I was talking with, again, Brad Frost and some other people, and we were talking about like front-end code handoffs and how you document and what the best way to do that is, and how, you know, how do we do this effectively or whatever. And somebody made the point that, like, I think it was Brad, but made the point of like, the handing off the front end code is the new handing off the PSD to get mangled. You know, it's kind of like the same thing. It's like, as it gets translated to the back end, it gets kind of junked up. And I've been on both sides of this thing, like where the designer is giving me these red line documents, which I hate, and I want to, you know, just whatever, send him, I don't know, into like a, spaceship or something like that. But then, you know, then I've also been on the like complete opposite side of it, where it's like, I'm trying to like convey things that were kind of wonky and like, hey, could you fix that? Recently it was like, we were working with a client, and they're a great client. They had a really awesome developer, and he went off and he implemented our little front end code into WordPress. And like, it's like a fully functioning web app and stuff like that. It's really awesome. But then it was like, we were going to go do some fixes, and I like cracked open ViewSource and was just like, why is this, why did this break, you know? And there's all these extra divs and stuff like that. So it's, you know, weird things happen. And I think we just got to be tolerant on both sides. What I can say though is, if you're going to report a bug, like give it a priority. Like this is super nitpicky, or this is super not important, or like this was kind of important to the whole design or whatever. I think that stuff helps like developers build empathy for what you were trying to do, in my mind. I don't know. So that's it.
Love it.
Cool. Awesome. Well, should we do one more? Emily, are you good for one more question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, here we go. Chris, you want to read it? Oh, this one's some hot drama here.
Which one?
The quotes. Let's save that one.
You like that?
So hot.
You know, it's something I gotta look into. It seems cool to me. It's the opposite of. Let's do the bottom. Wade Muller. I am wondering. I'm an artist and I'm rebuilding my website. What is the best responsive solution for image/video galleries? I need my work to be easily accessible on mobile. Problem is that most websites use light boxes, and this seems outdated now. What are your opinions? So let's say you're a photographer and you want to display your photos on a website, and you want them to be fine on mobile. What's the thing? I feel like there's a lot of things to think about here, because you want them to be big. You have that issue of like, I can't put 20 photos on one site, otherwise it will load super slow, and light boxes are kind of like, what's up? How do you ever, Emily, do you ever have that issue on websites you work on where the light box pattern seems to be the way to go, but you're not sure?
Yeah. And I think it's been a while since I've used the light box pattern, so it may be fading away. But yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, if it's not going to think about it from the mobile first perspective, if Lightbox isn't going to work on mobile, start there and design something that will work on mobile and see what the best implementation would be to do it on the desktop. So build sort of in reverse, and you'll probably wind up with a better desktop website.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, because we all know that images are like one of the hardest things to deal with in responsive design. So if you kind of start from let's not go overboard. Let's make them mobile sized first, and then figure out some way to flip them out for bigger resolutions. You're probably doing everybody a big favor there. I would spend, you know, like thumbnails, I don't know. So the problem is, you know, the design problem is I have a little image and I want people to view the bigger image. So Lightbox really, they were just everywhere for a while there. And it's true, like Emily said, it's just been a while since you've worked with it, but it's, is it because that need is gone or is it because they just, I've fallen out of trend or did, was there, did a different pattern replace it? I'm not, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think the need is gone. I think people want to see big images and enjoy them. But I, as a solution, I think it's started to get replaced with other things. And I don't know if there's one in particular that stands out as its replacement, but I think it has started to just fade out.
I would look at other websites whose primary function is showing images. Mm-hmm. So Flickr or something and see kind of how they approach the situation.
Instagram does a tube of content. I think that's the like popular thing is like tubes of content. But yeah, they also just do a
flick
Lightbox. Up,
flick, 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 flick. Do they?
Like on their website, if you go to your profile or whatever, you get a Lightbox with the little comment thing. But they also have this cool thing like where you can like go to a page as well of your image, I think. Like you can go to right. the actual URL of that page or whatever. So it's interesting. And so I think they're still around. I think you just got to be careful about using them, especially with mobile. Brad Frost has his, again, Brad Frost, bleh, that guy, has a bunch of patterns on this is responsive / patterns or whatever. And the conditional Lightbox is pretty awesome, where on mobile or whatever, it's like, you tap an image, a thumbnail, and it goes to that image, which is way more helpful than like loading an image in super tiny into the viewport in a Lightbox. So the Lightbox only kicks in after whatever 800 pixels or something.
Yeah, that's nice. And I think, yeah, so you have thumbnails, right? Thumbnails can be thumbnails on the desktop, or they could be the tube, you know, they could be the tube of content for mobile. And then you click on it, and now you're in JavaScript territory, and you can make the decision there. That's the hard part sometimes about responsive design is where and how can I make that decision?
Mm-hmm.
And now you know, you can do the tests that you need to test. Like, do I have a lot of room available? Can I just test that kind of, you know, the browser viewport width and decide whether I'm going to pop it up into a Lightbox or not? Or, and which image should I pop up into that Lightbox? Is it presumably you'll have to make a web request for that large image? And if you have a lot of space available, well, then request the big one. If you don't, don't. That is a very interesting question, Wade. I know we didn't give you a perfect answer there, but as with all questions, it's just the solution is very specific to your project and always kind of it's better to meander around and give you ideas than anything too specific.
Yeah. And don't use it just because you're like lazy and don't want to think of another solution. Try to find the best solution and maybe it is a Lightbox and maybe that's what you need to do. So anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that we're out of time here. So that's too sad. But Emily, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And if there's one big thing that you want to plug or how can people give you money, how does that work? Please let us know.
Well, I forgot to say this earlier. I'm also teaching a user experience design course at General Assembly, which is an education startup.
Oh, yeah.
Teaching user experience design starting in December. So I'm excited about that. But you can find me at emilydunkel.com or on Twitter at emilydunkel. And that's probably the best ways to contact me.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
And good luck awesome. on your mobilization journey and all the other stuff you're doing at work. Sounds pretty cool.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thanks everyone for coming out, listening to the show live in the chat room. You guys, have some great feedback. I was actually going to mention when we were talking about Macaw, other people were mentioning there's Adobe Muse, Adobe Reflow, and this thing called Webflow. So if you're interested in trying out one of those products, like those design in a browsery environment sort of things, those are all things you should check out. And be sure to follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter, and be sure to rate us up in iTunes or your podcast listener, your podcatcher. Is that what they're called? Podcatcher of choice. And Chris, you got anything for us?
Oh, I was going to grab my banjo, then I remember how out of tune it was. Anyway.
Mouth banjo.
Boom. ShopDocShow.com.
Oh, that was good.